This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Finding affordable housing has long been a challenge in Charlotte. We just don't have enough of it. This is workforce housing, housing for teachers, police officers, firemen, other workers who are being priced out of living where they work. At one point, the city decided it wanted to add 5,000 affordable housing units in the next 5 years, but because of the economic concerns that bubbled to the surface in the aftermath of last fall's protests, that timetable was sped up. Now, the city would like to accomplish the same goal, 5,000 new affordable housing units, in just 3 years. The goal is still far short of the need, but you have to consider the many roadblocks that stand in the way, not the least of which is a state law that says cities cannot impose affordable housing quotas. Still, ideas are being floated, and we'll hear a few this hour. We're joined by Luana Mayfield, Charlotte City Councilwoman representing District 3 and the chair of the council's Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you. She and our next guest are both members of the city's Housing Advisory Board, Joe Padilla, who is also executive director of the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And Eli Portillo is back with us. He's the development reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning.
Morning.
Luana, let me begin with you. Let's begin with something that some people might be puzzled about. How did the urgency of this affordable housing, this dearth of affordable housing, and the need for more grow in the wake of last year's protests? What's the connection?
Well, we have to look at the bigger picture and look at what we in Charlotte have the legal ability to do. So unfortunately, after October 10th, when the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott happened, the community wanted to know, what is your council going to do to help make this a better city? So for us on the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee, we really looked at, and the entire council, we know that the community wanted more safety, more trust and accountability, but also access to safe, quality, and affordable housing, because that makes a difference. Where you live, living in a safer community, those are some of the issues and concerns. It does not directly correlate with the shooting, mm-hmm. but it's that piece of what part of this puzzle can we play, and the part that we can play is, how do we get our public-private partnerships to really understand the overall benefit of having workforce affordable housing and having diverse communities?
Does you have a leg in both fields here, mm-hmm. Joe, because you are a member of, as I said, of the Housing and Advisory Board for the city, but you're also in the real estate industry, and sure. you're essentially a lobbyist, I guess, for the real estate and building industry.
Correct. Yeah.
Do you understand the problem? Does the industry understand the problem?
Oh, absolutely.
Do they care about the problem?
Very
it's
much.
Two
so.
Different things.
Yeah. No. Very much.
And
so.
Why isn't it being built?
Well, you have to look at what constitutes the cost of housing, and there are really five different elements to it. You've got land, you've got labor, you've got materials, and most of those are market-driven. You can't really affect the price of housing, especially in a growing city like Charlotte. Land values are going up. It's becoming increasingly expensive to build anywhere toward Center City or anywhere really, even as you get out toward the periphery. The two levers we do control are regulation and zoning, and I think we need to find ways to be more effective as we evaluate regulations, as we look at zonings and whether or not communities are going to be responsive and receptive to higher densities as we get in toward the urban core. Unless you have either higher density or lower land costs, which means you have to go much further out in the region to find those lower land costs, it's going to get increasingly hard to provide housing that working people can afford.
Right. And Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer, we've done, I can't count how many shows we've done about this, and I know you've been writing about this, far more articles than we've done shows on this for years. Is progress being made?
Well, there are a record number of apartments being built here. The thing is, most of those are at the very high end, so you're not seeing a lot of progress in terms of lower rents or developments being constructed where the price point is not in the luxury range. What you're seeing is a market that is very tilted towards the highest end of development, and that's for a lot of the reasons Joe discussed. One statistic that I heard last week that really struck me is that nationwide, according to CoStar, which is a real estate tracking service, about 36% of all apartments are in what they classify as 1 or 2 out of 5 stars. So those tend to be naturally affordable. They're older, they don't have as many amenities, and frankly, they might not be as quote-unquote nice as newer construction. But just because of that, they are naturally more affordable. The rents are lower. Mm-hmm. In Charlotte, instead of that 36% number you see nationwide, only 14% of our apartment supply, according to CoStar, is in that 1 and 2 star. And that's largely a function of how much new stuff we've built that's in the 4 and 5 star segment of the market.
I think my head's going to explode.
Well, then I'm either doing my job or not.
No. Affordable is a relative term, but not in this case. So define affordable or workforce housing. What are we talking about?
So when we look at affordable housing for the city standards, we go by the federal government's ruling, which is you should not be spending more than 30% of your annual income on your housing. But that also includes utilities that you have within that home. And I'm thinking most people kind of like to eat on a regular basis. So to cover your utilities and groceries, no more than 30% of your income should be going towards your housing. Well, unfortunately, what we have today is people spending more than or up to 50% of their income once you add in, if you're able to have a vehicle and all the maintenance costs that goes along with that vehicle. Our salaries, just like we saw prior to 2008, where the cost of living was rising drastically, but salaries were not keeping pace with that, we're seeing it again. But for us, when we look at affordable, you hear AMI all the time. That's the area median income. Well, 30% and below of our area median income, that would be the equivalent of when I first moved to Charlotte in 1988, I think my one-bedroom apartment was $475 a month. Today, you're seeing studio apartments that start at $900-plus a month. That is a considerable difference, but salaries haven't necessarily kept up for people to afford it.
Eli.
So according to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Planning Commission, the median household income has actually gone down since pre-recession here. So in 2007, that was $56,000 about, and in 2015, it was somewhere right around $54,000. So what you're seeing is rent going up very quickly, while median incomes not only are not keeping up with that increase, they're actually going the other way. So I think that pace of change and the fact that you're seeing incomes go one way and rents go very quickly the other way up is really driving a lot of this.
That's confirmed by a study that was put out not too long ago by the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, in which they said renter households are spending more than 30% of their income on housing. And that means they are, and this is a term that's used across the country, they are cost burdened. And yet developers continue to build these high-end units and rents keep going up. There's clearly a market for people who can't afford these. Why isn't that market being catered to in some way?
Well, it's a factor of economics when you're talking about what land prices are. And to give you an idea right now, if you can find if you're building a multifamily project, to give you a rough idea, a developer has to be somewhere in the area of about $25,000 per raw door in order to make numbers work. That means after you develop it and you actually build it, you're talking about closer to, $125,000. Per door, mm-hmm. once it's built and developed, you're going to get on average, Charlotte right now, you're looking at maybe 15 units per acre for multifamily. That's kind of pushing the high end of what neighborhoods will accept. So the math simply makes it very difficult when you're going to pay $200,000 and more in some cases for multifamily acreage anywhere in South End or in Center City. It gets very, very hard to make those numbers.
Are we exceptional because we're such a fast-growing city, or is this really something that's happening all over the country?
It's happening all over the country, but let's look at everything that was just shared and bring that down to everyday common terms. There was a development recently where they had townhomes and single-family attached. The townhomes started initially around $140,000. The single family around $220,000. Well, because Charlotte is such an attractive market because of our weather outside of Snowmageddon and that recent issue, we are still a very attractive area. Those homes now the attached single family are selling over $350,000. And that turnaround happened literally within 4 to 5 months. So then the question becomes for the developer, why sell it at the lower end if I have people that are going to walk in the door paying me almost double? You have no additional amenity in that product. Well, my challenge would be to say, okay, how about identifying a certain number of the units to stay at that entry level and then add one or two additional amenities and then continue to sell or add no amenities if people are willing to pay it, give them the opportunity, but don't eliminate the affordability part of it. Because I understand you want to make a profit, but when you're making that profit to the extent and the level where this just so much better than we thought we would, at what point do you recognize the community and the greater good?
This kind of puts government between a rock and a hard place.
Yes.
You have a lot of impediments, at least in Charlotte and throughout North Carolina, in terms of what you can do, what tools are in your toolkit. But on the other hand, you're saying that these new units are being built and they're not affordable, and the value of those units, driven by markets, continues to go up. So, and we'll talk about this later, but there's not a lot of incentive for a builder who is in the business to make money. He's not in there to build, to hammer nails. He's in there to make money. It's not a lot of incentive for them to reserve some units for lower-income people. No one's talking about why these people don't make enough money to live in Charlotte. These are hourly employees, most of them, McDonald's workers, Burger King workers,
teachers.
Some of them school teachers, etc. Why is government, is local government talking about this? Are they putting pressure on, for instance, the state to raise teacher pay, on businesses to raise the pay of hourly employees? Can you do that? Is that in your toolhouse?
So what I would say is that we actually do have a number of products. You think about our Housing Charlotte Down Payment Assistance Program, our single and family multifamily rehab program, the funding that we give for new construction through our housing trust fund dollars, because we do not have mandatory inclusionary housing. We have voluntary, so we'll give you a density bonus. We're also we just recently had a study by the Terwilliger Group that really looks at what other tools can we bring in the toolbox. Are we having conversations with our representatives in the General Assembly? Yes. Matter of fact, your council just returned from our annual retreat. We chose to have it in Raleigh last week so that we can build those relationships. In Raleigh, there's not a housing committee that is represented by any of the representatives on the House or the Senate side. That's a conversation that we started. We also started a conversation to say, what would it look like for you to give us a little more leeway? Because when you look at our dollars, we have $15 million in the fund. That $15 million has been that amount for a very long time. What if we were able to identify more of our tax dollars, if we were able to allocate more? That means we're able to be in a position for when that developer comes in, we're able to put a little more money in on the front end. Because if you go back the last few years, what you will see, especially through the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee, there was a time where we may submit 5 applications that included workforce and diversified housing. Maybe one or two would be approved because state funding was also a part of that model. Well, last year alone, we were able to get 4.
And what was the reaction in 10 seconds? What was the reaction of the legislatures when you brought that up?
The reaction was actually very positive to start the conversation. It's a new year.
Luana Mayfield is with us from the City Council. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Concerts, presenting the National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine, performing both Ukrainian and international repertoires, Wednesday, February 8th at 7:30 at Knight Theater in the Levine Center for the Arts. Tickets available at carolinatix.org. And Northeast Digestive Health Center, offering ReShape, a non-surgical weight loss procedure using dual balloon technology. More details at northeastdigestive.com. If you want to debate climate change, don't talk to a climate scientist. You may have a better shot with a meteorologist. As a group, they've been less quick to jump on that bandwagon, though the trend has started to reverse, probably because the 5 hottest years on record have come since 2010. So we're going to talk to a climate scientist and 2 meteorologists, one of whom has recently changed their mind about all of this, tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point in our 100-day spotlight on the Trump administration in a time of fast, dramatic action, how do we assure that we don't lose democratic oversight? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the dearth of affordable housing, a topic we've taken up on many occasions. But the problem is getting more dire, actually. And the timetable for building more has been accelerated, or for creating more, not necessarily building, but creating more has been accelerated, at least by City Council. Luana Mainfield is with us from Charlotte City Council, District 3, where she is also the chair of the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee. Joe Padilla is executive director of Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition, and both are members of the Housing Advisory Board on the council. And Eli Portillo is here, development reporter for the Charlotte Observer. There are too many things happening, along with this incredible explosion of apartments being built around the city. Many of those apartments and some townhome projects are being built on properties that were low-income properties, or at least had been stable-income properties for years, and the people living in those either don't want to live in these apartments or can't afford to live in these apartments. So what control does council have over that? Because just in the paper this morning, there was a project announced between, I think, North Tryon and Graham Street that will be replacing some lower-cost housing that's already been torn down. There are townhomes going in on the east side of South Boulevard. These are all areas that have heretofore been relatively stable, low to moderate income housing stock locations.
You're absolutely right. And as Joe said, when you look at the cost of building today, that's why we are really focusing on the city side, trying to identify what additional incentives can we create in order for you to recognize that we have an opportunity not to create a city of have and have nots. It's interesting. This past weekend, I was part of a panel of religious teachers, and they asked the question of what do I see is the biggest challenge. Honestly, I see the biggest challenge as being poverty. We have to figure out a way to create better jobs, better paying jobs. We do not have the legal ability. We had legislation that came down last year that told municipalities you cannot increase the minimum wage. We have to really work to build relationships in Raleigh to have municipalities to have the control and the flexibility to do what's best for our communities.
And again, this is happening all over the country. It used to be that a struggling actor could afford to live in Manhattan. It'd be a fifth-floor walk-up studio apartment, horrible place, but nonetheless you could afford to be there. You can't do that in New York anymore for the most part. It's all high-dollar people living in New York City right now. The same thing is happening here. So is it realistic, Joe, from your point of view, with your feet in both worlds, for the council to say, no, we need to have 5,000 or 3,000 affordable housing units, not in 5 years, in 3 years? Is that realistic?
I think it's audacious. I'm
Is that a good thing?
Well, you know, it's always great to have audacious goals.
The audacity of hope. I've heard of it.
I think you've got to have some reasonable, achievable goals as well. We would love to see that goal be achieved. I think it's ambitious. But I think the reality we have to look at, and I'll come back to the regulatory environment, is that there is so much that the city can do to help moderate the cost of housing. Again, there are things you can't control. You can't control land values going up. As long as we're growing in a desirable city, land is going to get more expensive. But when we look at zoning, and we're in the middle of rewriting or starting to rewrite our zoning ordinance right now in Charlotte, when you look at our development regulations that require everything from a street grid that can get very expensive and connectivity that can get very expensive. We want aesthetic design. We want brick on a lot of the new buildings that are going up. We want sidewalks that are, you know, 18 feet wide with planning strips. We want all of these things, and nothing wrong. I mean, these are all valuable things, but they cost money. And every time you add a regulation that bears that cost, it's going to make housing less affordable. So we have to, as a community, start to really evaluate every regulation in light of what its impact is going to be on affordable housing. And I don't think we're doing that right now.
Eli.
So I think in terms of whether the goal is realistic, you have to look at the way it's worded. I believe it's actually put to create or preserve 5,000 units of affordable housing. So that means that in theory, the city could count a lot of units that are currently affordable that don't get redeveloped towards that goal. So you could see that goal achieved, but not a huge increase in the raw number of units that are affordable. And part of that, I think, is because it's very hard to get housing built right now that is actually reserved for people of lower income. Mm. Since 2001, when the Housing Trust Fund was established, there have been about 5,500, roughly, units financed by that. So they're talking right now about building or preserving the same number of affordable units that have been built with the Housing Trust Fund in 15 years over three. So that's a very high goal.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's going to be hard to do that the way it's being done right now, 50 or 60 or even 100 units at a time.
If it is difficult to persuade builders and developers to include in their new developments at least some units set aside for affordable housing purposes, and if the incentives have gone fairly much ignored, and they have, what tools do you have to persuade people who have older housing stock that is currently affordable and perhaps being rented to keep it that way when land is being gobbled up faster than the turkey at Thanksgiving right now? What is the incentive? What tools do you have in your toolkit to convince those people to maintain their properties as they are?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, I want to mention that we're already at 26% of our goal just looking at January to December of 2016.
How have you done that?
Right. That is, as was mentioned, we cannot build our way out of it. So that is definitely, along with new development that has come out of the ground, that's using our rehab program, that's using our House Charlotte Down Payment Assistance Program. We're also looking at a neighborhood revitalization, which is something I'm really excited about, that Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee was able to move forward last year, where we're going into two targeted neighborhoods, and we're going to do a neighborhood revitalization. So those older homes that were built in the 30s, 40s, that need to be brought up to code, but seeing brand new development that is double what their house cost is being built next door or directly across the street, to come in and look at the overall holistic approach. But one of the other things that we're really looking at, when we go back to the idea of what is our relationship with Raleigh, we're getting ready to continue those conversations to revisit. We have a biannual amount of housing bond allocation. We're going to talk to them about giving us the ability to increase that bond allocation for multiple years.
You are essentially, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not an expert on this, you are. You are essentially subsidizing the problem by putting this housing fund to work, rehabilitating homes, helping people get into these affordable housing units when there are not many being built.
Subsidizing the solutions, yes.
And people get upset by that.
Some do.
Well, and you're doing this because the government is actually subsidizing business. Is that right? Would you say that's true? Because if you're not making a living wage in Charlotte and you can't afford property and the city's coming in to help you do that, then the city is not only subsidizing you, they are subsidizing McDonald's. And I'm not picking on McDonald's here. They're subsidizing fast food workers and teacher salaries, et cetera. They're not high enough.
I wouldn't say that we're subsidizing. I would say that we're doing our part to make sure that people have the opportunity to have access to quality housing. When most people think of subsidies and they look at the corporate arena and you look at the millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, it is a drop in the bucket what the city has the ability to fund towards diversified housing options. But it is only going to work through the relationships of not only the development community, the philanthropic community, the religious community. Look how much land churches own. And if there was a real conversation to utilize some of that land for diversified housing options. So I wouldn't say that we're subsidizing the problem, but I would say that we're subsidizing the solution in order to get more options.
Joe.
Yeah, I mean, I would point out, I think public subsidies are a key part of the solution. And the reality is we cannot fund our housing trust fund at $15 million every 2 years. That is paltry, and it's not going to get the job done. If affordable housing is, and it should be, a community-wide priority, then we have to prioritize it and pay for it as a community. We have to all have skin in the game. One of the frustrations people in our industry have is the private sector is frequently asked to bear the burden where, quite frankly, with economics the way they are of land and development costs, if you're looking at someone who's making 30% AMI or even 50% AMI, 50% AMI in Charlotte is about $27,000 a year. You're going to be able to afford about $685 a month. There is not going to be a private sector developer that will be provide housing at that price point. We have to look at a public solution, and we have to have significant amounts of money on the table to do that.
So some people would say, who are listening, would say, so what? If they can't afford to live in Charlotte, move to Gastonia, move to Lincoln County, drive in. What's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with them saying that. The challenge is the reality of that could easily be you. So when we think about those who have contributed to the growth and the beauty of our city that now are in financial positions that may or may not have been within their control, you think about it. When the downturn happened, you had a number of people who were making more than 50% of the AMI, their jobs were eliminated, the company moved, whatever the challenges were, and they didn't necessarily step right into a new position. So we're saying we're going to punish you for the fact that when you moved here, it was quite affordable, but because new development has come and it's been decided that this same land is now valued 3 times what the value was when you first invested in that community, you look at Wesley Heights. At a time, the community had homes that were valued at $20,000, $35,000. Homes are over $600,000 there now. So we're going to say that the person who invested when the community was first starting to transition, well, you know what? You need to leave now and go find a home in Gastonia, even though we don't have public transportation to bring you to and for work. Or we're going to say, just move out 50 minutes from your job and get up early if you don't have a car and figure out a way to catch the bus and hopefully once the train is extended, figure out a way to use public transportation to get in. That's not the city that we are. That's not who we are as Charlottians.
Eli.
Well, I think that also housing and where people live and where they can afford to live underpins a lot of the problems that you're seeing in Charlotte right now around areas such as the school system, resegregation in the schools. A lot of that is tied to the patterns of where people live and where they can afford to live. And as long as we want to address those problems, I think it's very hard to do that without addressing housing and where people are able to live, work, send their kids to school. It's all tied together in one big knot.
And in writing about this in The Observer, you raised a question. You said, even if the city reaches its goal, will it actually resolve underlying issues? Are those the issues you're talking about?
Yes, I think those issues are really polarizing. You've seen that come out in a lot of the public debate, especially since the Keith Lamont Scott shooting. Mm-hmm. You've seen, I think, a real breakdown in the way that people are communicating with each other. There's, you know, folks who never get out of their part of the city, whether it's an affluent part or a part with poverty. And I think in a lot of ways that stratification, segregation, and separation in the city is fundamental to housing and is a lot of what we're really talking about here.
Joe Padilla.
I think Eli brings up one of the big questions we've got to grapple with as a city as we look at this problem. We can build, I think, more affordable units. The question is supply. There are areas of the city right now where land is reasonably affordable enough where you can build that product and build it in a fairly quick fashion because you have the land values to do it. If our goal, on the other hand, is going to be what we call inclusionary zoning, which is let's go into South Charlotte and let's, build in South Park and let's build these units in Myers Park, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. We just have to look at the reality of the economics of it. It's a lot more expensive to build. You're going to take that limited pool of dollars you have in the public sector and have fewer units in those areas than you would in areas that are less expensive.
And the goal is 5,000 new units in 3 years. And that, I said at the beginning, it doesn't even scratch the surface of the need. The need is 34,000 units. Right. And you point out in one of your articles, Eli, that the city is growing by 109 people a day. Do we know how many of those 109 people coming in every single day need affordable housing?
Well, that figure actually includes births as well as people moving in, so it's not quite a one-to-one.
Right.
I believe the 34,000 units needed estimate is by HUD at the federal level, and that's over the next few decades. So I think that as long as we keep seeing 109 people a day, you know, and including births, that also includes people who have kids and want to move out of a small apartment, and then that creates a demand in the for sale marketplace as well. As long as we keep seeing very rapid growth, we're going to keep seeing problems of affordability, probably no matter how many new units we build. And in some ways, what we're talking about here is a product of good things. You know, if we had the population decreasing and rents falling, businesses moving out, we would not be, you know, necessarily jumping up and down with joy about that. So the rebirth of Uptown, the emergence of South End as a serious neighborhood where people want to live instead of an area of largely disused warehouses and industrial space, these are things that we point to all the time in the city as, wow, great, you know, Charlotte's growing, Charlotte's world-class city, it's really emerging. But those are also the same things that lead to lower-income areas near Uptown being redeveloped. Those are the same things that lead to upward pressure on rents because there are a lot of affluent people moving here. So we've seen a lot of growth, and that growth is a good thing, but it's also driving this in a lot of ways.
By state law, the city cannot impose quotas on the number of affordable units a developer has to include in a particular new project. But the city has, Joe, offered incentives to developers and builders to encourage them to include affordable housing in their new projects. But not many developers have taken advantage of those incentives. Is that because the incentives aren't enough to overcome the monetary realities? Why?
I think it's partially both. I think, yes, that we need to revisit that policy. We need to see that that was drafted about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think the expectation is we'd always have to come back and revisit and tweak it. I think the bigger problem, though, is the type of development you're seeing right now in Charlotte is not single-use development. That policy was written specifically for someone who had a by-right zoning. If you're R2, you can go to R4 and get that density. Well, many of the projects, I would say a majority of the projects coming in now that have housing are mixed-use developments. They're MUD. They're conditional zonings. You know, you don't have a lot of these single-use neighborhoods, and that incentive program was not designed to incorporate that.
Joe Padilla is Executive Director of the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition. He's here with Luana Mayfield from Charlotte City Council and Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer. We have to take a break. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Fresh Market, offering appetizers, premium meat, specialty snacks and beverages, weekly items featured at thefreshmarket.com. And the Charlotte Symphony, presenting Second City Guide to the Symphony, the troupe that launched the careers of John Belushi and Stephen Colbert, celebrating the symphony with comedy and music February 4th at Belk Theater. Info at charlottesymphony.org. The Trump administration has been swift in taking executive action in a short period of time. So who's minding the store on OnPoint's 100-day spotlight? They continue with a look at checks and balances in government. That's coming up at 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We will continue our conversation about affordable housing and what might be done to increase the number of affordable housing units in the area. And you can join that conversation at Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org, on Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
British Prime Minister Theresa May is in the United States to cement what some call the special relationship between the two countries.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
The idea was to replace the aging Memorial Stadium and Grady Cole Center near Uptown with a new $175 million stadium.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo from the Charlotte Observer, Joe Padilla from the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition, and Luana Mayfield from Charlotte City Council District 3. Luana, a lot of high-profile people, among them Harvey Gantt, the former mayor, former chairman and CEO of Bank of America, Hugh McCall, have said that they'd like to see mandatory quotas placed on developers to include affordable housing units. It's forbidden by state law. You just came back from Raleigh. Did this topic come up? And would the legislature allow more urban areas like Charlotte, like Raleigh, Durham, Greensboro, do this? Because we need to.
Well, there has been some success on mandatory inclusionary housing, but the realities are this is still a very new conversation that we're having with the General Assembly. It is no surprise that Charlotte and Raleigh have had some tension over the last few years, so we're really trying to rebuild relationships again. But what I want to highlight is what are we doing? So moving into 2017 and beyond, we're continuing to make our Charlotte funding support awards, which really helps to offset those costs. We fill that gap for that housing. We're looking at internally creating a position to have someone that's just focused on what are the best options out there across the nation, looking at a manager council form of government.
You can't make builders do this.
No, you cannot.
But you can ask them to, and they can always say, no, not going to do that.
But we've had some to say yes.
But your fellow city council person, Ed Drake, says quite often the ask isn't made. Is he right about that?
I would challenge that a little bit. The ask is made, but I think a lot of it, as was mentioned earlier, falls in our policy. So if the policy, which we're in the middle of a rewrite of our NDO, and we're having a conversation about what language do we give you developers? So when you're looking to develop, if we don't have it clearly stated that there is an expectation or a clear goal in the writing that there is diversified housing throughout the city, not just certain parts of the city, then when the developer has done their rezoning process and they've gone through however many thousands of dollars, and then they come to council, and then the council members ask the question, is there an affordable component to this, and do we have any options? Well, by the time they have the conversation with us, it may be many months down the line. But can we change that conversation where on the front end, when they're talking to planning, it is clearly known that there is an expectation or a desire for there to be truly mixed income housing?
So one area where local government does have some leverage is when they are selling government-owned land to a developer. For redevelopment, they can include as a condition of the sale that, you know, 10%, 20%, X number of units in that development are affordable. And you've seen that with the county's plan to sell what used to be the Brooklyn neighborhood, the publicly owned parts of that, to a developer for Brooklyn Village. So you can get some units out of that from developers in a way that you can't with development on private land.
Even if the city came in on the front end, as Luana Mayfield just mentioned, and told their developers that there would be an expectation, and that's all it could be, an expectation that affordable housing units would be included, is that likely to be successful, Joe? Because your industry favors loosening regulations, not increasing them.
Oh, I know, absolutely. I mean, the challenge with mandatory or even, you know, encouraged inclusionary zoning is in many ways it doesn't work. The reality is if you look at mandatory inclusionary zoning programs in cities like San Francisco and Davidson, they're not producing the number of units. What that program really does is it says to the neighbors in that particular development, you folks are going to subsidize the housing of your neighbors. And I go back to the issue of we need as a community to say how do we all have a stake in the game, not just people who are moving here, because ultimately those individuals, if they look at their rate going up for their unit 20%, they're going to go somewhere else.
Some of people in your industry have suggested that expediting permits, reducing fees, making changes in zoning procedures would all help reduce the cost of new housing and help make the inclusion of affordable housing easier for developers. Really? I mean, how much would those changes really save money enough to offset the cost of building affordable housing?
Well, I mean, you have to look at it sort of in a broader context. I mean, no. One policy change with an expedited permit is not necessarily going to be the silver bullet that gives us every unit we want. But when we look at continually compounding the regulatory environment, City Council last week, for example, was looking at a policy to put 8-foot planning strips and 6-foot sidewalks on every new by-right development. So if you're doing a development on Providence Road or on Beatty's Ford, you now have to give – if this passes, you would have to give – 14 to 16 feet of right-of-way that you'd lose from that development. These are all policies that add to the cost of housing. And no, not one policy
but
change
if that,
is going to
make a but if those but, are amenities that people want, doesn't that ultimately raise the value of what you're building?
Well, that's the question we have to ask. I mean, what is our priority going to be? If our priority is going to be bike lanes and wide sidewalks and planning strips and all of these other things that we all – look, they're great. No one's arguing that these are valuable things. But when they take away the ability to deliver affordable housing, that's the context that we've got to make that decision in.
So a study by the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, which I referenced earlier, suggested some things that Charlotte can do legally. They could establish a community land trust in which the city would own land and sell houses on that land to homeowners who would then agree to restrictions on how much they could sell that house for in the future. Have you held any discussions on that?
Actually, we have started having that conversation in Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee, and we're also in the process of reviewing not only all the land that the city owns, but we're also in partnership with CMS as well as Mecklenburg County to have that conversation that Eli mentioned where we can, for the land that we own, whereas for that private developer, we can ask, but our land, we can mandate that there is going to be, you have to develop X percentage of affordable housing if you want to develop on this land, because I honestly believe we missed the opportunity last year. Because another conversation is political will and political ability. There is an ability that we may have on the local level, but at the end of the day, it still takes 6 votes.
Your organization, I think, is against this the restriction of selling it beyond a certain level. What's it called? It's called
equity capture, basically.
Restrictions on sales of home, the price of a sale of home.
Oh, on yeah.
Deed restrictions.
Deed restrictions.
You're not in favor of that at all. Would that go over with people to say we're going to cap your ability to build equity in your house if you want this as an affordable unit today?
If it is tax dollars that pay for this land, if this is land that tax dollars have paid for, what we're giving are other options. For the private landowner, we're not putting restrictions on how you're able to sell your land. We do not have the ability, nor would you want government to have that ability. But if this is land that is owned or purchased through tax dollars, then yes, there should be an expectation that we're not going to let you come in, be able to purchase the land at a very low price, but then you be able to then turn around, sell that land for a very high profit, and no one else has the same ability to come in, whether that's a starter home or it may be a long-term home for a family. When we're talking about tax dollars, our ultimate mission should be that of the greater good of the community.
I think what Councilman Mayfield's talking about is land, and we would agree with that. I don't think anyone would dispute that the city and the county and the school board should and have every opportunity to put conditions on the sale of their land to use that to create affordable housing. Our concern is with the ability of new homeowners to build equity in their home. That's the value of homeownership. That's the American dream, is wealth is generated. When you buy that first home, you want to be able to build the equity that your neighbors are building and then sell that or reap that equity either through cashing out to spend for other things in your life or just to resell it at a higher value.
There are several people who have been emailing and Facebooking and tweeting here, particularly about zoning. Patricia emails, isn't the biggest tool Charlotte and Mecklenburg County have in their toolbox zoning and planning? As I see it, they've given developers everything they wanted and forced lower-income families into the starter homes in the outer reaches of the county because it was more profitable for the builders. Stuart on Facebook, let's talk about how zoning laws are just arbitrary decisions to enforce protectionism in a market. Whenever a property is zoned commercial, a housing developer is denied the opportunity to build housing, resulting in pressure and higher prices for housing. When zoned residential, potential businesses are blocked out, hurting employment opportunities and access to goods. This is the number one cause, he says, for poor conditions surrounding affordable housing. What's your take on that? Because I know you're trying to overhaul the housing code. Well, Eli, you take that then.
Well, I think that
you take it.
Sure. I think that we could do a whole other show on zoning.
Exactly.
Just invite me back for that. But I think that what those get at is the tension between the two ways that we've been talking about addressing this. One of those is by deregulating and taking restrictions off builders and hoping that they will lower the costs that they are renting or selling in response to lower costs of operating. And the other way is more regulating and mandating, you know, hey, everybody's got to bear this burden, so everyone has to include X percentage of affordable units. And those two comments really show that in a lot of ways, these two ways of addressing the problem are kind of opposite, but they both really get to the fundamental regulations. And zoning, which we're trying to rewrite in this city, is one of those.
Can you do a test to say, in this area, we're going to do it this way as an experiment, and over here, we're going to do it this way as an experiment to see what ultimately happens?
Yeah, I think you can. And I think one of these suggestions, recommendations in the UNC study is for an affordable housing overlay zone where effectively you go into a particular neighborhood where you say we are going to give developers the right to come in without a rezoning and build as long as these affordable housing inclusions are there. So that is one tool. You know, the reality is, as Eli pointed out, I mean, we're a city, and every city is like this, where people don't like density and they don't like sprawl. So those are the two tools you have to make housing affordable. Either more units breaker or you go further out.
And the rezoning that you're working on won't be ready until 2019. Is that correct? If it's done then?
Hopefully. That's the plan, because as we're learning more, we're trying to overhaul, but understanding that what is by right land and what you can develop on. And if you're going to come in and ask for a rezoning, especially if you're going to ask for any assistance, either through a tax increment grant or through a tax increment financing, again, if you're using tax dollars, then there has to be a community good. So when you talk about the sidewalks, and the fact that we want a walkable city, because young millennials don't want cars anymore. So how do we create a city where you can safely get around and have affordable housing?
We are experiencing an explosion in new apartment developments, and most of these are not in the affordable housing category. Most of them are higher end, or at least they are because they're brand new. We'll see what happens to them in 5 or 10 or 15 years. But nonetheless, as these new apartments are being built and proliferating, does that lower the value of older units and therefore make them become affordable housing units?
Well, I think in relative terms, they're going to become more affordable, but I don't think inherently you're going to see a decrease in their value. You know, the reality is the newer apartments that are coming in with rents of, you know, $1,800 to $2,500 a month are catering to a market. And you know, Councilwoman Mayfield alluded to millennials who are moving here, and that's a lot of who is moving in there. Some of them are in a roommate situation, others are not. But, you know, anecdotally, we're hearing that most of these apartments are filling up. They're 60 to 70% leased before they even open.
The Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition is holding a meeting Thursday, 1:30.
Wednesday.
At 1:30 at the UNC Charlotte's Uptown building to offer some possible solutions to this problem. And you're bringing in a guy named Wendell Cox, who is the author of The War on the Dream, How Anti-Sprawl Policy Threatens the Quality of Life. He's not a new urbanist, is he?
No, he's not. And we like to bring in people who are going to be a little edgy and who are going to sort of shake up sort of our conventional thinking.
Well, if I understand his thesis, It is conventional thinking because the new urbanists are the unconventional thinkers.
Barely,
but what he's saying is it kind of goes to the opposite of what we've been hearing. That they've said that the last 60 years of zoning rules have encouraged urban sprawl. These are the new urbanists.
Right.
That's what they say. And led to the commuting culture that we have today.
Right.
They favor greater density and zoning rules that allow for greater density. They want to see compact, connected, live, work, play urban environments that reduce the use of cars. He wants to go back to the old way? He says that's a better way?
Well, I think what his argument is, and hopefully those who will attend tomorrow, it's a free event up at UNC Charlotte, his perspective is, I think, very economically astute, where it basically looks at if you want to have affordable housing, you have to put that housing where land is less expensive. That is generally in your periphery of your community. Now, as Councilman Mayfield pointed out earlier, the challenge with that is people need to drive further to get to their place of employment. That puts more cars on the road for all of us, which is problematic. However, it is a tool that we need to recognize. When you go out to some of these suburban counties and you can only get zoning at one unit per acre or 2 units per acre, then we are creating an environment where you're either high density in the city or very, very low density in the suburbs, and there's no area in this region where you can build 4, 5, 6 units an acre and deliver that $150,000 housing product that we need.
Very quickly, Teresa tweets, the big question is, will the housing be spread throughout the city, affordable housing? Will it?
And that's the goal. We want true disbursement.
Why not, Terry emails, why not to have the city buy vacant lots, offer them to the target groups at a discount to build homes on, keep a lien on the value for a certain time to avoid speculation?
And that's the conversation we just got through having is what would it look like for city-owned land and us to put stipulations on that land, maintaining affordability.
And Lewis writes, one strategy is not enough. Multiple homesteading programs could provide a significant increase in affordable housing. These include granny cottages for non-related households, incentives for duplex conversion of single family, and tiny houses up to 800 square feet. And 1.5 floors.
We have actually, I personally have met over the last few years with 3 different tiny home developers. As we're looking at rewriting our rezoning, we don't have language for tiny homes. We're looking at what would that look like.
LaWanna Mayfield, City Council District 3, Chair of the Housing and Neighborhood Development Committee, Joe Padilla, Executive Director of the Real Estate and Building Industry Coalition, and Eli Portillo from the Charlotte